From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last year, the architect Amy Seek wrote a deeply personal memoir about giving her baby up for adoption. She tells about why she made the decision and how, as she puts it in the book, everything had been shaped by his absence. Amy chose the couple who would raise her son. She said she wanted people who she could see as part of her own family because this was going to be an open adoption and Amy was going to have some kind of relationship with this child. But what kind of relationship? She describes the situation as an awkward choreography where she's offered a place at the table, but she's not sure where to sit. Today in the program, we're talking about adoption. Amy Seek will join us, among others, to talk about the history of adoption, but mostly the experience of it and how that's changing. After the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. So let me just get this out of the way as a sort of matter of disclosure. I was adopted as a baby, only 4 days old. And like most adoptions of the time, this was the 60s, it was a closed adoption. And so I don't know much of anything about my birth mother or birth father. And I mean, it was really closed. I actually don't have a clue about family health history, anything like that. I do know she was 16 when she had me, and I imagine it being scandalous and probably secret. Thankfully, things have changed. And just how things have changed is part of the conversation today, because we're talking about adoption, particularly open adoptions, as almost all adoptions are these days. And we're going to begin from the perspective of the birth mother, because last year, the landscape architect Amy Seek wrote this remarkable memoir about her experience giving up her baby. It's called God and Jetfire, Confessions of a Birth Mother. Amy Seek works as a landscape architect in New York City, and she's joining us today from a studio in New York. And Amy Seek, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to begin with this story you tell right up front in the book. Where you're writing about this dream, at least I think it's a dream, and
it is.
I figured, yeah. And you're with your son, with Jonathan, and as this dream unfolds, he's 10 or 11, and you're lying on your bed, and you reach over and you say to him, "I wanted you." I want to begin there. Why was that important, even in the dream, as you're imagining it? Why is it important for you to say that to him?
Because within the context of an open adoption, even given the openness, there are things that I don't say to him because I don't want to cause conflict. I don't want him to see regret in me. Mm-hmm. I don't want his adoption to be perceived as primarily painful, or I don't want to remind him that there's pain, even though it's something I can't be reminded of because I'm constantly aware of it, and possibly there's a part of him that's always aware of a loss in his history as well.
Yeah.
But I don't feel I have the freedom. It feels like a betrayal of his parents to reach out to him in that way.
Yeah. And then he says to you, as you're imagining this thing that won't happen, but that you're dreaming about, is he says, you know, you say, "I wanted you," and he said, "Yeah, but why?" And he just sort of absently says it in the sense that it's kind of that universal question.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you're lying there having this moment. On one hand, the question is kind of profound, but on the other hand, it's really kind of that ordinary moment that moms have with their kids where they ask mm-hmm. these kind of simple but existential questions. I want to have you read this section, if you would, so we can talk about something you say in this part. Would you read this part for us?
Yes. "It was just like him to contemplate such things, and it was very much him lying there, skeptical slits of eyes piercing the ceiling, weight so real he sank into my duvet. It was exciting to have him there with me, and it was fun to be cohorts confronting the universe together. But the most fantastic thing was touching him. No one was watching, and I wasn't thinking about whether it was okay or whether it made him or anyone else uncomfortable or whether I was allowed to express my love like that without restraint. I didn't think about anything at all. I just reached over and combed through the blonde mop, bent the warm, rubbery flap of his ear as it felt natural to do, as I had, in fact, never once done. He had never been to my apartment, and we had never lain like that. I'd never said those true words, making sure he understood. I'd never let my affection flow straight from my heart, through my outstretched arms, and land so solidly and without hesitation. I'd never enjoyed that relief, profound, even as he turned and let it roll to the side, his mother's love, imponderable as eternity, shedding it as a son will do. If I could have, I'd have turned to my other side and put his question to my father. But when I woke, there was just the west, buildings gleaming pink, illuminated by sunrise, and another eternity to contemplate. I would never, ever, ever be my son's mother.
What do you mean, ever be your son's mother? I mean, what are you?
That is the constant question.
Yeah.
It's what I ask myself every time I plan a trip to see him. It's what I ask when I'm in his presence. What I ask myself when I'm in his presence, how should I be to him? What is my value? I could always be more, but maybe I should be less. There's no model for this. We're all figuring it out, and we don't talk about it a lot. And it's not something that feels comfortable to talk about with his family. We just know that our relationship has a value.
Mm-hmm. In that section, and this seems like this is really important. You talk about the importance of being able, at least in that moment as you're imagining it, to touch him when no one's watching and when mm-hmm. you don't have to worry that it makes anyone feel uncomfortable. As you said, being able to express your love without the restraint of reality. The fact is, he's someone else's child now in that mm-hmm. sense. So how do you think about, do you kind of lose that right, that relationship when you give a baby up for adoption?
Well, I know that it's different for everybody. Yeah. And there are definitely people who have relationships with their child who they gave up, which are much more physical. And I only know that my own experience is that I don't feel comfortable in that way. And there's a way in which in this section, and when I really did have this dream, it was a moment that I realized that is in a way what motherhood would be, is this utter comfort with that animal body and your body as being the same flesh. And it was something I got to experience for the few hours that I had him. It was a couple of weeks that I had him.
Yeah.
And I had no doubt about how to be with him and how to be with his body as animals. And now I hug him and he carries my bags.
Because he's 15 or something now, isn't he?
He's 16 now.
16, wow.
But there's not this, I just can't reach over and touch him like a mother.
Yeah. I think one thing about your book, and the reason it seems to have resonated with so many people, is that you expressed these feelings that birth mothers felt like they had no right to feel. Or you came out and said that I really want to touch him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that resonated with people, even though, as you said, the experience is very different from some. Some feel like they can't and shouldn't, and it seems like that's kind of where you are. But that you talk about it, that you kind of say it out loud, seems remarkable to people, don't you think?
Well, yeah, I think that increasingly, birth mothers are feeling comfortable telling their stories. But there has been a long history of feeling that you made this decision so you don't have a right to your grief and you don't have a right to make other people aware of your grief.
Yeah.
And I think that was a big part of telling this story, was that there are many, many, many birth mothers who have stories like this and who experience grief every day.
People said to you, and this is kind of a crazy part of the book, I think, or the story anyway, and I don't mean that flippantly. I just mean, like, people said, look, Amy, it's a bad idea to get so close. It's a bad idea to have natural childbirth. It's a bad idea to breastfeed the baby. It's a bad idea to have the baby for the days that you did. Mm-hmm. But you insisted, and I wanted to ask you about that, because you've talked about how you figured that if you couldn't give him up after having that kind of intimacy, then what? Then maybe you shouldn't?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It seemed to me the best test of whether or not I should do it. If I couldn't do it, then it's not something I should do. And I didn't feel like a mother should blind herself to something she was about to put her child through. And so it felt, I had a very deep maternal instinct that I had to experience the pain in the most excruciating intensity, because if I couldn't bear it, I knew he couldn't bear it, and that we shouldn't bear it, that we should bear whatever difficulty would face us if I was to be a single mother, but not that separation.
Yeah.
And it's something that now increasingly it seems to be there's research that shows that birth mothers should have this time with their child and should have a bonding period, that it benefits the child to have that. And if I could do anything, I would have made it longer.
Did it benefit you, though?
It's so funny because my instinct is it doesn't matter what it did to me.
Yeah.
Because, but yes, it definitely did. Those were the best days of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. You write about, a lot of the book is about this process that you go through of choosing the couple to adopt the baby. And one of the things you've said about that is you were looking for, this was so interesting, that you were looking for people who didn't seem desperate or paralyzed mm-hmm. by not having a baby. Why was that important for you?
I just knew that my baby wouldn't satisfy whatever thing it was. You know, it wasn't going to be the baby that they wanted. They weren't going to have the satisfaction of the biological connection. And it was scary to put that burden on a child to fulfill this family's expectations. It just seemed like there was something unresolved in them and emotionally unhealthy. And now that I'm 40 myself, I have a lot of friends who are facing not having children. And I'm happy that I had that instinct, because I think it, too, among us, there's a process that you have to go through of accepting whatever comes and being able to adapt to it. And the family that I chose they were really so all right with whatever happened. And I thought that's a better entry point into an open adoption, where as unpredictable as parenthood could be, I think open adoption is probably more so, because you're getting not only a child you don't know, but a whole extended family.
Yeah. Well, that is how you've put it, is this is kind of, I guess you were trying to imagine people who would be part of your family. Is that how you kind of wanted it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I wanted them to be people that I just had a feeling I want to find out what's going on with that person. I want to hear a story that person would tell about this. And they are full of amazing stories, and I love talking to them. So they're people who I could imagine befriending in my life without this experience.
It's interesting you didn't really formalize a contract. You wanted this sort of see how it evolved, the relationship?
Well, the open adoptions are not binding legally in most states in the U.S. anyway, and so it seemed a little bit unnecessary to begin with. But there was a spirit of not wanting this to be a contractual obligation. There are many families that we were advised that we could write that we want 6 letters a year and we want pictures every month. Mm. And that seemed like a burden for like, what if they missed a month? Then would I think that this adoption was over? And there's just too many unpredictable things about an entire life that we would share. And so we just decided that we needed to find people that we trusted enough that we didn't need a contract.
Yeah.
And I couldn't have given my son to anyone else. There was no one else I could have developed this level of trust with. And we went through many, many couples and just didn't feel that instinct. And as it has turned out, they've been utterly true to the kind of relationship that we described.
You've You know, people sometimes have asked me, like, when did you learn that you were adopted? And I know it's different from everybody, but like in my situation, my parents never sat me down and said, okay, we need to tell you something. It was just, we always knew. So there was never really ever a moment. And I wanted to ask you, because you've talked about the fact that if kids have access to their birth mothers, the question about being adopted doesn't seem dramatic or traumatic or any of those kinds of things. It's just kind of, the questions are kind of easy, you've said. Mm-hmm. Is that what you meant?
Yeah. In that excerpt that that we've talked about, his responding so simply to my saying, I wanted you, he's just like, okay, yeah, I've heard that story.
Right.
I think there is a simplicity about those kind of questions and the questions. He has many opportunities because I see him pretty often, and it can text me and email me. And so the questions come in very small bits, mm-hmm. and they're easy to answer. And I'm sure that there's a bigger question in him, and I'm sure there's a deeper struggle. But we're building the relationship that hopefully will have an intimacy that will admit to those kind of deeper questions at some point in his life. But for now, it's a lot of logistics. When did you come? When did the adoptive couple come after you had me? And then, well, they came right away.
Yeah. Let me ask you this finally. You write about those first days when you knew you were pregnant and how you kind of felt inside, how you felt inside what you called the early seeds of a lifelong grief. What did you mean by that? That you was that part of the maternal instinct that you saw this coming? Not only you were giving the baby up for adoption, but that it was going to exact some kind of cost.
I think, I don't know that I had any premonition at that time about what this would all mean, but when you're pregnant, I just had a sense that everything was about to change, and I didn't exactly know at all the nature of that change. Mm-hmm. And when I began, I mean, it's something that the counselors would try to tell me, you know, this will be hard your whole life, but it'll get easier as time passes and you'll move on with your life. And I trusted them because I kind of needed to trust them, but I also had the sense nobody who was advising me had gone through this. And what I know now is the grief just changes. Now I'm missing a 16-year-old, and next year I'll be missing a 17-year-old. And what I've heard from other birth mothers is that when they have other children, it actually awakens a whole different level of grief because they're intimately aware of the things that they missed with their first child. And so I think I knew that everything was going to change, but it wasn't until the moment that I had my son and I looked at him that I was a new person. I could barely even reflect on what I had been before. I couldn't even remember it. And to let go of him, to be this new creature and adjust to the idea of an adoption was too much for any woman to do really knowing what she's doing. And I think that's part of the struggle of the adoption professionals now is to be able to communicate that kind of change that happens to a woman. You can hardly have informed consent when you are signing away a child.
It's Amy Seek, her extraordinary book called God and Jetfire, Confessions of a Birth Mother. Amy, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll take a brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about adoption, and there's a lot to talk about when you're talking about adoption. We're focusing on the history of adoption and where we've ended up now, because adoptions used to be a secret and kind of shameful thing. Families didn't talk much about them. Records were closed mostly, but a lot of that has changed. Joining us now on the program is E. Wayne Karp. He's an emeritus professor of history at Pacific Lutheran University, the author of 4 books on adoption, including Family Matters, which looks at the history of adoption. He's joining us today from public radio station KNKX in Tacoma, Washington. And Professor Karp, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to ask you about the history, which you mentioned when you wrote your book. It's been almost 20 years now, but you said there wasn't really a book at the time that examined the history of adoption. And I guess the reasons are obvious. Is it because it's always been bound up in, you know, secrecy and shame and closed records, those kinds of things?
Absolutely. Researchers were unable to learn much about adoption because the records were sealed and closed to them. However, my book is, on the one hand, based on adoption records. I was privileged to access them at the Children's Home Society of Washington. And also, there are many social welfare journals, and one can follow the history of adoption through reading them. And they go back to the 1890s, 1900s.
Adoption is – this interested me. You said adoption, and by that I mean some kind of law or in any way formal understanding, is as old as humanity itself. The Babylonians, like 4,000 years ago, had some kind of adoption process?
That's true, but in Western society – legal adoption is a fairly recent institution, so that in the United States, the first adoption law is not passed until 1851 in Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Child Adoption Law, which provided for the legal adoption of a child with judicial oversight. And in the following years, in the next 25 years, most states also legalized adoption. One can also look, for example, at England and discover that they didn't have a law of adoption until 1926, yeah. Ireland until 1952.
If you go way back, though, that's the thing I was referring to, as you mentioned, the Greeks, the Egyptians, the Romans in Africa,
sure.
in the Pacific Islanders, there were adoptions going on, in whatever the form was.
There were adoptions, but for very different purposes than modern adoption.
Right, and I think that's a crucial point. Explain what that is, because what you say in the book is those adoptions weren't so much about the kids; they were about the grown-ups, I guess.
That's a good way of putting it. Not only children, but adults were adopted, and they were adopted for purposes of inheritance. They were adopted to keep the kinship line going. And those were two of the basic reasons.
This was interesting to me. You write about how in African, Asian, South Pacific cultures that it was common for adopted children to maintain a relationship with their biological parents. But that wasn't the case in Western societies. Why is that?
That's a very good question. I don't think I can answer simply on the basis that they're different cultures. And in a Western society, let me back up a little bit. That was true in the United States. This sort of informal adoption did go on, not so much as an open adoption, especially among the African American families. They took care of their own, as it were. And so if a child became an orphan, other families would step in and take them in. The thing I wanted to say is that secrecy is really also recent, which is not well known.
Yeah.
People think that adoption in the United States has always been secret, but adoption was open in the sense that adoption agencies kept records, and when an adult returned to an adoption agency before, say, World War II, the adoption agency would actually help the child, who is now an adult, locate their birth parents by giving them the information that they had in their adoption records. It's only after World War II, for a number of reasons, that this changes. Why would adoption agencies do this? They would do this because back then, the children who were adopted had an average age of 4 years. They were 4 years old and older. And the idea that you could keep secret that they didn't have any birth parents was not even thought of. In fact, the whole reason that adoption records began was to allow these children to grow up and come back and find their birth parents.
And so why did it change?
Well, there's all sorts of demographic and other reasons, but the big change, demographically, the children who began to be adopted were infants, and they had no knowledge. Yeah. But after World War II, adoption agencies began to take their cue from psychoanalytic studies. And these studies looked at single mothers, and they concluded that these women were neurotic or even psychopathic, and that they were very sick. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they advised adoption agencies that the best thing that could happen to the child would be to separate them for adoption.
Right.
And that's sort of the beginnings of secrecy. Because as I've written in my book, Family Matters, adoption records were open in the sense that adults could come back and find out all the identifying information about their birth. And it was only after World War II that they began to be sealed.
Yeah. You mention in your book, Family Matters, this idea of kinship, that what really mattered was the idea of blood kinship. And so you say this kind of stigmatized adoption as socially unacceptable. There was this idea that taking a child that wasn't yours or taking it into your home was in some way abnormal or unnatural.
For a certain period in history, it's very true. And this is a function of what is called the eugenics movement that began about 1890 and spread from England into the United States up until the 1930s. And this was the idea that there was genetic material that created criminality in children from unwed mothers. Mm-hmm. That is, unwed mothers were diagnosed as being feeble-minded by definition of having a child out of wedlock.
Right.
And that in turn made the child carrying the feeble-minded gene. And there were books written about generations of criminals and welfare cheats and this sort of thing coming from a feeble-minded women. This eugenics movement climaxed really with the sterilization of these women being put into asylums and also put this social stigma on the institution of adoption. And so adoptive parents for a long time were very wary of adopting a child for fear of this feeble-minded criminality gene, which is totally fallacious and pseudoscience.
Yeah. This was interesting, too. In your book, you write about how parenthood after World War II came to be seen, you know, having kids came to be seen as patriotic. So couples who couldn't have children were kind of marginalized. It came to be seen as kind of wanting. So I guess this may be one of the reasons why adoptions also went up in that period?
Right. Well, there's two reasons. One, after I'll just say this. The one good thing Hitler did was he made the eugenics movement totally verboten and destroyed it. And so that stigma of feeble-mindedness and eugenic problems disappeared. And so there wasn't that fear. On the other hand, after World War II, you have the baby boom. And it became a social benefit to have children. You were thought of as a patriotic, but you were also thought of as doing the right thing, like having an iPhone and said, you have two children and go to the suburbs.
Yeah.
And so childless couples felt that they were marginalized or had a stigma of not having children. And that began a boom in adoptions.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about when you look at the history that you've written, you begin with this, how there was it used to be that the focus of adoptions wasn't on the welfare of the child. It was on the needs of the adults, religion and kinship and community, all those kinds of things. And then it shifts away. It shifts to being about the interests of the children. Do you think we've sort of swung another way when you look at these open adoptions now, this new era of open adoption? Do you worry in some way that it might be shifting back to being more about the interests of the adults?
Open adoptions have pluses and minuses. And so I don't think it's shifting away. I think open adoptions have a lot of advantages for adoptive parents. They know medical and psychological background. They can anticipate problems. They have a reduced fear that maybe the birth parents would come back to reclaim the child. And birth parents have advantages, as we've heard. It does lessen the grieving period. It definitely lessens distress over the fate of the child. And they have a sense of control, certainly, over the adoption process. And the child itself has advantages. They can get information that would satisfy their curiosity. They can experience a greater security over their own identity. On the other hand, there are disadvantages. That is, open adoption, for example, threatens the stability of the adoptive family. It creates great complexities and challenges adoptive parents. And it increases the fear of challenges from birth parents. So who's in charge? Who's the real parent?
Yeah.
And also, as we sort of hinted with Amy, that birth parents begin maybe to want the child back or regret the because of contact. The disadvantage for birth parents is their grief, their distress may actually be worse because they know where the child is and they may begin to regret their decision. And for the children, the disadvantages of open adoption might be that it can create confusion about their identity. Who are they? Who are their parents? The two sets of parents might be very confusing. And also a child can, you know, manipulate the situation and play one set of parents against the other. And so there are great advantages to open adoption, and there are also some disadvantages. Open adoption is the sort of dominant form of adoption now. Some at least 80% or more of adoption agencies are in favor of open adoption. And the few studies that have been done have pretty uniformly emphasized the advantages in terms of interviews that they've done with birth mothers.
That's E. Wayne Karp. He is an emeritus professor of history at Pacific Lutheran University. He has a number of books on adoption, including Family Matters, Secrecy and Disclosure, and the History of Adoption. Professor, we're glad you joined us. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about adoptions, about the history of adoptions. Open adoptions, really, is what we're focusing on. Jerry Rapier and Kurt Bateman are joining us now. They're adoptive parents of an open adoption. About 4 years ago, they traveled to South Carolina to adopt their son, Oscar. His birth mother, Emily, lives in South Carolina, and his birth father, Tyson, lives in Utah. And we should mention Jerry is himself an adoptee. The Bateman Rapiers live here in Salt Lake City, and they're joining us in the studio. Welcome, guys. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so I want to start with the decision you made to have an open adoption. Like, how I know, Kurt, for you, this was a tougher sell. Jerry having been adopted, that may have influenced it. We can talk about that. But just in general, like, start with that, like the idea, like, I think not only have an adoption, but have a relationship with the birth mother. Is that how you were thinking about it?
Well, definitely. My adoptive mother did me a great service by allowing me to be in contact with my birth sister, Kathy, who lives here in Salt Lake City and is someone that is central to my life. And that when Kurt and I decided, it took us about 10 years to decide that we were going to adopt. And when we finally decided, it was just a no-brainer that we would seek out something that facilitated caring for the birth mother, whoever she may be, and give our child even greater opportunity than my adoptive mother gave me. It was easier for me to make that leap because that was my experience. And I don't want to speak for Kurt because
I was terrified.
This was tough.
I was terrified. I didn't know any different, really. And the most open an adoption I had experienced was my brothers, and they have an open adoption with their daughter's birth mother, but it's a photo and a letter once a year.
Yeah,
and that's open. So I was absolutely terrified about it. In a workshop with our agency, the administrator said, look, you've got to take all of these fears and questions that you're having and you've got to just filter them. Are they coming out of your fear? Yeah. Are they coming out of your, what we call a child-centered approach? Are they coming out of your fear or are they coming out of your faith that you'll do the right thing for the kid?
Right.
And when she said that, everything changed for me about open adoption. By the way, hi, Emily. We love you.
She's listening. I've been texting with her about
Oscar's
Amy's book.
Birth mom is listening. Okay. Yeah. But wait, what do you mean by that? So what was the revelation then that you...
The revelation was that for me, living in fear was going to stifle almost, and it had really up to into my 30s. Most of my decisions had been made out of fear. Yeah. If I was going to... parent out of fear, everything, I shouldn't parent, basically.
Yeah.
So if I'm going to parent, I'm going to always think, what are we doing? And your previous guest mentioned a lot of the benefits for the adults in an open adoption. And I'm going to respectfully disagree that open adoption is child-centered adoption. It is about the child, at least in our case. And
you hear that with Amy too.
Absolutely.
Like she didn't deflect the question, but she was like, I don't want, because I said, was it good for you? And she said, I almost don't even want to answer that.
Which I think Emily would say the exact same thing.
Like, what didn't matter? It was about Jonathan. It was about the child.
And but I will correct Amy. For her, maybe it's giving up. We don't say giving up for adoption. That's a swear word in our house and
but
around.
I think I said that.
Yeah, but she did too. And we say placed.
Okay.
We say that the birth mother placed, not gave up, because it's. I think for the child to hear give up or giving up brings a layer of loss that doesn't need to be part of the story.
But didn't Amy give up her child? Didn't Emily give up Oscar?
Absolutely not.
I mean, I get why Oscar, you wouldn't want a child to hear that word, but isn't that what Amy's story is about? In part, is that the grief of giving?
Well, I think the grief is separate from the words that we're using. A great example, we talk about, Oscar will tell anyone who will listen to him, that he has a birth mother named Emily. We were standing in line at Wendy's not too long ago, and he just turns to the guy behind us and says, I have a daddy and a papa, and my birth mother's name is Emily. So immediately we sent Emily a video while we were sitting there to tell her about it. One of the reasons we sought out the agency that we did is that to make sure that we knew how to navigate these conversations. And within a few I think it was 4 or 5 weeks from the time that we knew that Emily had chosen us, we got on a plane and we went to Greenville and we met her. Mm-hmm. We had had several phone conversations.
And Tyson, too, by
and
the
Tyson,
way.
And Tyson, who
Oscar's
was there.
Birth father.
As well, which is a crazy, wonderful thing that we have that a lot of people don't have, is yeah. that we have both of them.
Yeah.
But we had to, we weren't looking for a child with no strings. Yeah. We were looking for an additional component to our family. And that means Emily and Tyson, too. They are our family. They are Oscar's family, and they will never not be that.
It's true, but isn't it? It's hard enough being a parent.
Absolutely, it's not.
So why?
Easy.
So
it's
why do
easy.
You want strings?
Yeah.
Why? I mean, why would it would be so? It seems to me it would be just absolutely forgivable for you to say, "I don't want that other stuff."
You know what? It really is such a good question, Doug, because it's so true. I mean, and in the human, in the Kurt Bateman condition, all roads are the easy road. Absolutely, right. No question. It is not easy. It's not easy. It's there's, you know, there's complications. There's costs involved. You know, who's going to pay for Emily's next trip out? Is how much can we afford to help with that? Is there there's navigations. There's contracts to be made about. Well, will he call you? What will he call you?
Right.
All of those contracts need. It's not easy, but it's for him. It's for that boy who all four of us love. So much. Jerry and I, we just think about Oscar and we'll burst into tears. But we know that no matter how much we love him or care for him, that doesn't change how much Emily loves him and how much Tyson loves him too. And they will always love him. And no matter what we do, they will always be his parents.
Yeah. And huh. Emily sent me a text the other day when I told her we were going to be on the show. And she expressed pretty much what Kurt was saying, that how much love is too much love for a child.
Yeah.
There is no such thing as too much love for a child. And I feel like Emily also mentioned in the same text that she feels like she can be more open with us sometimes about the difficulties of being a birth mother,
yeah,
than she can with maybe other members of her family, yeah, or other people in her life. And I feel like,
because you guys will understand in a way no one else would,
and we care. At the core of everything is we care. We love Oscar. He is our son, but we love Emily because she is our family.
That's kind of what Amy was talking about, is she wanted to be part of that family. She wanted to think of it as a family. And you guys are talking about that, of course, the principal thing is the child, but that you did think a lot about the well-being of Emily and that process of after she lets go of the child, what happens to them after that? I mean, that's what Amy's book is about. And what you're saying, seems like what you're saying is we wanted to make that part of this experience, like take that into account, not forget that part, that which must be excruciating.
It is tricky.
Absolutely. And for me, there is a moment in my life that is singular to me. I will never forget it. It is maybe one of the most painful things that I've ever experienced. You know, and my brother died. I've had to come out to a very LDS family. I mean, I've experienced some pain in my life. But there was a moment in the hospital, and we were so lucky. Emily invited us into the hospital with her. She wanted us there.
Yeah.
I mean, she wanted us to be the first ones to hold Oscar. I mean, this woman, she also, I mean, I think that there's a stigma. Birth mothers are drug addicts or you know, or...
Something's wrong with them.
Yes, something's wrong with them. These two young people, Emily and Tyson, in their early 20s, trying to decide what to do for this human being. And there was a moment alone. It was on Thanksgiving, and Jerry walked out. And I knew I couldn't say this in front of Jerry just because we both, again, come to adoption from a different place.
Yep.
But I just... And I'm an emotionally... intuitive person, and I could feel it, and I could feel her anguish, and I just looked at her in the eyes, and tears are streaming down my face. And Emily, she's not really a crier, And I said, Emily, even though we have fallen in love with you over the last 3 months and you have fallen in love with us, you cannot go through with this adoption because you love us. You have to do it for the reasons that you decided to do it in the first place, or you have to back out.
Yeah.
And it was this intensely vulnerable, and she burst into tears at that moment, and she said, I know it's right. I'm just hurting, and I want to move forward, but I want him to.
Yeah.
So to see the strength, to see that strength in this young, young, intelligent, beautiful woman, I'll never forget it. And it has been a bittersweet thing for my son's birth to have gone through grief and joy at the same time.
Yep.
But I feel so privileged to be his father. You know, I feel so privileged.
What do you say? I wonder how you guys were reacting, because you were listening to our conversation with Amy earlier where she read that beautiful passage in that beautiful book about how she would never, 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 ever, ever be her son's mother. Like, that relationship had was changed. I wonder what you make of that.
Well, Emily actually just texted me right before we started and said, no, you guys are his parents. He doesn't have two set of parents. But we have a very unique situation being a gay couple.
Yeah.
That there's only one person who could ever carry the title mother in our world, and it's Emily. She's always – we agreed that he among us that he would call her Emily, and we would refer to her as his birth mother. But there's we are daddy and papa, and she's the only one that could be referred to as a mother of any sort. And it seems when Oscar – he'll be four next month. As he starts to tell his friends about his family, that seems to give him some power too, that he can help them understand, these little kids having these amazing conversations.
I know, but –
He has three fathers though. You know, I mean, on the other hand, Tyson is – a birth father.
But wait, because this is what Amy was getting at, is like, in my dream, I can touch him.
Yeah.
I can't in real life, not in the same way. And what she's saying is there is a boundary. There should be a boundary.
Is.
So what do you guys, you know what I'm saying? What's the boundary?
Open adoption is not co-parenting.
Right.
That's the distinction that I think a lot of adoptive parents fear. It's not co-parenting. Emily and Tyson don't make decisions regarding the day-to-day happenings of Oscar's existence. Yep. So it's not co-parenting. But there's absolutely a boundary. Emily and Tyson, I know that they have to filter what they say through do his parents want us to say this?
Yep.
And what kind of touch they give him, do his – absolutely. And you know, that is a contract that is going to be different with every family. We personally want our birth parents to be physically very physical with Oscar if they so want to. But that's a contract. Yeah. Yeah. Emily is not going to ever be his mommy.
Yep.
And that's hard.
Yeah. I think that is hard. I'm sure she would say that's hard. Certainly it's hard for Amy as she expresses that.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a dream that she's touching.
I burst into tears the minute she read that. It was beautiful.
So let me ask you about Oscar. He's four now.
Yeah, in 5 weeks. He's been playing the role of a four-year-old for a few weeks to get ready.
Well, but that gets to the – I mean, he's super – as anyone who knows him, which I do, sort of, he's very vocal.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Expresses. So what are the questions he's asking now? Like, what does he say to Emily? What are the questions that he asks about this bigger thing that's going on in his life?
Well, I think right now, like, not this last video that – we sent Emily the other day, but the one before, he just asked her when she's going to come visit again.
Yep. It's not the big stuff.
No,
yet.
Not yet.
Because he's
known her his whole life too.
But isn't that what Amy was getting at too? Is she's like, that's what's great. There's no big traumatic thing.
He did ask me what he's like. When did we meet? And I was like, well, we met the day you were born, son. But I think he would have asked that of at this point of if he was with a biological father. You know, it was simply one of those young kid inquisitive questions.
Let me ask you this finally. Is it okay if a mother doesn't want to, if she just does want to give that experience up and put it aside and let someone else raise the, you know, is that okay?
I think so. I think it's up to it's up to her.
Yeah.
And I think our experience, we come at it from a unique angle that some adoptive families don't come at it from. My adoption story is very complicated. But we understand that there's a gamut and choice has to be part of it. And her experience is just as important as Oscar's and just as important as ours. Yeah. And the only way we can know what that is if we stay in touch with her. And if she's part of Oscar's life and we want him to be able to talk to her whenever he wants to.
I agree, but I also think that it should be a birth mother's decision for sure, whatever she decides to do. But I think in my world, it's the best thing for the child if she'll stay involved.
Yeah.
Kurt Bateman and Jerry Rapier. Their son, Oscar, turns 4 on November 20th. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. You're already planning the party at our house.
Wow, that was amazing that you know that.
You're on by it.
I do know that. I know that for a certain reason. I have a son whose birthday is November 20th. All right, thanks you guys very much.
Thank you.
For being with us. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.